Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, November 13th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. Now let's get started with some local news from Fort Dodge. Our first headline for Fort Dodge today reads, "The Icing on the Cake. Service clubs collect nearly $3,000 in groceries for local food pantries." How long does it take to spend $500 in a grocery store? On Sunday, several local service groups showed they could spend that much and more in less than 6 minutes. The third annual Service Clubs United Shopping Spree Foodraiser collected nearly $3,000 worth of groceries at Fairway on Saturday afternoon for five local food pantries. The service groups, Evening Lions, Kiwanis, Noon Sertoma, Daybreak Rotary, and Noon Rotary, competed to see which group could fill their grocery carts with as close to $500 without going over, and they each had 6 minutes to do it. They all lost, but several local food pantries were the winners, as their shelves will be stocked just in time for the holidays. Though none of the service groups kept their bills under $500, Daybreak Rotary came the closest with $511.73 and got to take home the Service Club's United Nutrition for Nonprofits trophy. "It's very exciting," said Daybreak Rotary President Kevin Thompson. "It's all fun, and win or lose, everybody wins." The group's carts of groceries will be donated to the Lotus Women's Shelter, which is located between Fort Dodge and Vincent. "The trophy was just icing on the cake," Thompson added. 3 years ago, when Linda Klein was president of the Fort Dodge Kiwanis Club, she saw a story about a similar shopping spree fundraiser in the Kiwanis International magazine and decided to organize an event here, inviting all the local service clubs to join in. Klein is now the Lieutenant Governor of Division 2 of the Nebraska-Iowa District of Kiwanis International. The event also gives the different service clubs an opportunity to intermingle and do something together for the community. "It's great," Thompson said. "I think we should work together on a lot of projects. That's the community working together, and everybody wins." In total, this year's shopping spree collected $2,869.55 worth of groceries. Fairway manager Chris Palm donated an additional $50 gift card to each service group. And here are the food raiser results. Fort Dodge Daybreak Rotary collected $511.73 for Lotus Women's Shelter. Fort Dodge Noon Sertoma collected $512.75 for Upper Des Moines Opportunity Incorporated Food Pantry. The Fort Dodge Kiwanis collected $520.72 for Fort Dodge Community School District food pantries. And the Fort Dodge Evening Lions collected $551.20 for Holy Trinity Catholic Parish Food Bank. And the Fort Dodge Noon Rotary collected $773.15 for the Lord's Cupboard. Our next Fort Dodge headline reads, "Fort Dodge Bridge to be renamed in honor of Al Habhab. Veterans saluted, an annual event." When Al Habhab left Fort Dodge some 70 years ago to become an Army soldier in the midst of World War II, he was only beginning his service to his country and community. The combat veteran would go on to serve as mayor of Fort Dodge for 12 years. Then he was a district court judge and later chief judge of the Iowa Court of Appeals. His legacy of service will be remembered in at least one very visible place, the bridge on First Avenue South. At the conclusion of Friday's Veterans Day observance at St. Edmund Catholic School, it was announced that the bridge will be renamed the Albert Habhab Veterans Memorial Bridge. Tom Dorsey, the adjutant of American Legion Post 190, read the resolution the city council will approve tonight, officially renaming the bridge. Habhab then received a standing ovation from the members of the public and St. Edmund's students who filled the school's auditorium. It was a surprise ending to a traditional community salute to those who have served in the military. Veterans come in all sizes and shapes: Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Coast Guard. But the one thing we have in common is that we challenged ourselves at a very young age to serve our country by joining the military, said Mark Thompson, a retired Marine Corps colonel from Clarion, who was the event's keynote speaker. St. Edmund Catholic School student McKenna Dillard started the observance by explaining why Veterans Day is always commemorated on November the 11th of each year. She said that on November 11th, 1918, World War I ended. The day was then celebrated as Armistice Day and evolved into today's Veterans Day. Dillard then joined her fellow band members in playing patriotic music, including the national anthem and a medley of all the armed forces' songs. Thompson recounted how he started in the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, but dropped out. He then enlisted in the Marine Corps, completed officer candidate school, and was commissioned as a second lieutenant. I believed in what I was doing, and more importantly, I believed in the Marines I was serving with, he said. Thompson offered this advice to the students in the auditorium. The decisions you make today have an impact on your entire life. Please take them seriously. Failure is only failure if you quit, he added. The Color Guard of Veterans of Foreign Wars Post 1856 opened and closed the event with flag ceremonies. In addition to the band music, the 7th and 8th grade choir sang during the Veterans Day observance. Our next local news headline reads, local companies partner to produce video that highlights Fort Dodge. Scenes of combines churning through bountiful fields and sweeping overhead vistas of downtown come together in a new short film to drive home this point. Fort Dodge is incredible. Fort Dodge is incredible is the title of a newly released mini-documentary produced by Land of Lakes and New Cooperative. The documentary features scenes of area farms, Fort Dodge, agribusiness plants, and Iowa Central Community College. Included are voiceovers by area farmers Brian Wagner and Laura Bunda, Dan Dix, general manager of New Cooperative, Emily Stuckey, co-owner of Community Orchard, and Jesse Ulrich, president of Iowa Central Community College. It was filmed in early September, according to Angie Britton, marketing manager of New Cooperative. The project really began with the knowledge that most people don't truly understand where their food comes from, said Heather Malinchek, chief marketing officer of Land of Lakes. As Iowans know, 87% of America's food comes from rural communities, she said. But those who don't live in rural communities seem to think they are dull places, she added. They have the view and misconception that rural communities are not vibrant, she said. We've set out to change the narrative on that, Malinchek said. She said the Fort Dodge film and a similar one about a community in California show rural communities as the vibrant places they actually are. She said Fort Dodge was selected from the thousands of rural communities in the nation because of the strong partnership between Land O'Lakes and New Cooperative, and because the city is, quote, a very good example of the kind of vibrant community the company wanted to highlight. The community values are really pretty powerful, she said. Malinchek said one of the most impressive things she learned during the project is that 77% of Iowa Central graduates stay in the area. And here's how to see the film. Links to the film, Fort Dodge is Incredible, can be found on the City of Fort Dodge Facebook page and the social media pages of New Cooperative and Land O'Lakes. It can also be found on YouTube. Our next headline reads, in thanks for their service, pheasants bring local hunters and Chicago's first responders together. Pheasant hunters working their way across the Iowa landscape is hardly unusual at this time of the year. But a couple of the hunting parties out and about in the Fort Dodge area over the weekend were unique. They consisted of local hunters, plus firefighters and police officers from Chicago, who were invited as part of an annual event to thank them for their service. We had a wonderful day, I'll tell you that, Tom Ryan, a retired Chicago firefighter, said Saturday evening. I've never seen so many birds in my life. The annual outing is organized by Jim Kirsten of Fort Dodge and his former college roommate, Doug Aller of Chicago. Aller, a financial advisor, manages investments for the union representing Chicago firefighters. He is also a hunter and outdoorsman. Merging his connection with the Chicago firefighters and his love of hunting, he has been involved in events in the Chicago metro area, such as No Child Left Indoors, Fish with a First Responder, and First Responder Outdoor Days. 4 years ago, he and Kirsten came up with the idea of treating the Chicago firefighters to a pheasant hunting outing in Iowa. This year's outing included four current or retired Chicago firefighters and one Chicago police officer. They were joined by Webster County Chief Deputy Derek Christie and Badger Volunteer Firefighter Luke Huggins, plus other local members of Pheasants Forever. Ryan said he was invited to the hunt by one of the current union members. I gladly accepted, he said. It was quite a treat, he added. He said he shot three pheasants with his late father's gun, a 70-year-old Belgian Browning 12-gauge double-barreled shotgun. I know he's looking down with a big thumbs up, Ryan said. Jerry Beck, a local leader of Pheasants Forever, said Saturday's hunt took place at two locations, one by Harcourt in Webster County and one near Eagle Grove in Wright County. All the hunting took place on private property that is in the Federal Conservation Reserve program. Beck said the group near Harcourt bagged 25 birds by noon. Sunday's hunt was to take place in Webster County, west of the Ag Industrial Park, called Iowa's Crossroads of Global Innovation. The hunting took place on land owned by C. Richard and Joan Stark, Bruce and Deb Becker, the Norm Lundquist family, and Gary Cathcart. I would like to thank all the landowners who allowed us to hunt, Kirsten said. I would also like to thank all first responders for their service. In addition to Beck, Pheasants Forever members Rick Taylor, Matt Carlson, Norm Lundquist, Matt Garner, Nate Jones, and Rick Jones helped organize the hunt. Saturday evening, the hunters dined on two pork loins donated by Pheasants Forever member Troy Anderson. And now turning to local obituaries, first we remember Tom Bratland. Daniel Thomas Bratland, 76, of Bend, Oregon, and formerly of Fort Dodge, went to be with our Lord and Savior Thursday, October 23rd. Interment will be at North Lawn Cemetery at a later date. Next, we remember Lawrence Kopp. Lawrence Kopp of Lakeville, Minnesota, passed away Saturday, November 4th. Larry will be dearly missed by all who knew him and loved him. A celebration of life will take place in Fort Dodge around his birthday this upcoming May. Next, we remember Timothy Holton, Sr. Services for Timothy will be Tuesday at 1 p.m. at the East Olensvang Cemetery of Thor. The Lentz Funeral Home is serving the family. And finally, we remember Kermit Smith. Kermit Smith, age 94, of Fort Dodge, died at the Marion home on November 10th, surrounded by his family. Funeral services will be held at 1:30 p.m. Wednesday at St. Olaf Lutheran Church. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Tuesday at Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. And now, turning to today's opinion page, Leah Glasgow, who's President and Chief Executive Officer of Unity Point Health Fort Dodge, has submitted a letter. And it reads, "While November is a month to be thankful, it's also a time to spread kindness to those around you. When I look around, I find so many things to be thankful for. My growing family, a great community, and an amazing team at Unity Point Health Fort Dodge, committed to excellence. But I'm also thankful for the acts of kindness shown by our team members to patients, visitors, and family members. I continually hear stories about how our team goes above and beyond to make a difference to those visiting our facilities, along with providing top-notch care. Recently, a patient locked their keys in their car and needed transportation to a second appointment at the Berry Hills Center. Our guest assistants transported the patient to their appointment at Berry Hill via the shuttle and then worked with the towing company to get the patient's keys out of the car. When the car alarm went off and the car wouldn't start, they Googled a way to get the car to start and save the patient a towing fee. I also love reading patient nominations for the Daisy Award for nurses and the Rose Award for patient care technicians, where stories are shared about how our team members performed acts of kindness and showed passion for the work they are doing. I'm so thankful we have a great group of team members who truly love the work they are doing, and it shows in each patient and family member interaction. Kindness does make a difference in the lives of others, and amazingly, most people do these actions out of love, compassion, or generosity, not expecting anything in return. World Kindness Day, a movement started by the Random Acts of Kindness Foundation, is today. We're using the day to kick off a season of giving at Unity Point Health Fort Dodge. Throughout November and December, our team members will not only receive acts of kindness, but we've challenged them to give back to our community and show kindness at the same time. Kindness is truly all around us in our community. My challenge to you is to go out and do acts of kindness to those around you, maybe by sending an unexpected card in the mail or an uplifting text message to someone to brighten their day. If you're looking, you will easily see so many acts of kindness all around us." And continuing on the editorial page, we have this headline, "Help Salvation Army by Ringing Bells. Holiday tradition supports those in community who need help. Like Christmas trees and turkey dinners, the red kettles and bell ringers of the Salvation Army are a traditional element of the holiday season. Just about everyone has seen the kettles and heard the jingling bells over the years, and hopefully just about everyone has put some donations in those kettles to help those less fortunate. Now the Salvation Army needs some help to keep that fine tradition going. It is in need of people willing to stand next to a kettle and ring the bells. In recent years, recruiting bell ringers has proven to be a tough chore. However, it is not difficult to actually stand and ring the bell. Volunteering to ring the bells gives an individual an opportunity to get outside and meet a lot of people. Most importantly, by volunteering to ring the bells, people will be contributing to a long tradition of helping others. We urge everyone who can to volunteer for a shift ringing bells for the Salvation Army. Yes, it will probably be cold outside during the bell-ringing shifts, but we're Iowans. We're used to winter weather. The Salvation Army nationwide has an easy way to sign up for a shift ringing of the bells. It's called registertoring.com. Once on the web page, a person can type in their zip code to find available times and locations to volunteer. Volunteers will get a text message reminding of them of their shift 2 hours before it begins. We ask everybody to visit registertoring.com, find a shift that works for them, and then get out there to make a difference in our community. And now turning to local sports headlines, we have this one that reads, Vogel places ninth at state swim for Dodgers. The dateline is Marshalltown. Haley Vogel and Julia Eastman didn't finish where they wanted to, but now they know where they need to go to achieve their goals. The Fort Dodge swim team competed at the state meet on Friday and Saturday. Vogel, an 8-time state qualifier, came away with a 9th place finish in the 50 freestyle. The junior squeaked into the B final with a time of 24 seconds 0.92 in the 16th spot. Vogel turned it up a notch in the final, placing 9th with a time of 24 seconds 0.73, or that's 0.19 faster. Vogel was 18th in the 100th freestyle with 54 seconds 0.78. The prelims didn't go exactly the way she wanted to, and she barely made it, said Fort Dodge head coach Ashley Beaumont about Vogel. The final was exciting. She came from the outside lane to win the B final, and we were all pumped up for that after the prelims. The 100 freestyle didn't go how she wanted either. She had a good race at regional, and it's hard to drop time. The Dodger 200 medley relay team improved 0.6 of a second to earn a 14th place showing with a time of 1 minute 52 seconds 0.35 after a qualifying swim of 1 minute 52 seconds 0.95. This is very bittersweet for Reagan, Beaumont said. After the medley, there were so many tears. Her smile and hard work will be missed. She was a great leader, and she wasn't always the loudest, but she cares for everyone. She was one of the first ones I coached 10 years ago since being in the club, and it's kind of an end of the era. Competing on the relay was senior Reagan Woolridge, Vogel, classmate Julia Eastman, and sophomore Gracie Harvey. Eastman just missed reaching the B final in both the 200 IM with 2 minutes and 14 seconds 0.09 and the 100 backstroke at 1 minute 0.92. The junior from Southeast Valley placed 23rd as a sophomore, but is now closer to reaching the finals after improving. Julia puts so much pressure on herself, Beaumont said. She barely missed it, and now she has to enjoy the momentum after a great regional meet. The 200 freestyle relay team of Eastman, junior Delaney O'Connor, freshman Kylan Lubinsky, and Vogel were 24th in 1 minute 43 seconds 0.65, faster than qualifying. The girls are pretty excited about the medley, Beaumont said. Haley had a fast split at 23 seconds, and that was a great start to the finals. The 200 freestyle, that one was exciting. There are no seniors, and they continue to drop time, and we have set ourselves up to break the school records. All three, O'Connor, Lubinsky, Harvey, had good times in the relays. Their goals are to continue to make the relays and to try to qualify for individual events. And you're listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, November 13th. On IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's news for Mason City. And our first Mason City headline today reads, Bird Flu Confirmed in Cerro Gordo County. The dateline is Mason City. Bird flu has been confirmed in a mixed species backyard flock in Cerro Gordo County. The Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship and the U.S. Department of Agriculture Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service confirmed Saturday that positive cases of highly pathogenic avian influenza are present in Cerro Gordo and Kossuth counties. The affected site in Kossuth County is a hatchery with game bird, pheasants, quail, and chukars. The North Iowa cases come on the heels of reports that an additional 1.2 million chickens will be slaughtered to prevent the spread of the bird flu after the virus was confirmed on an Iowa egg farm in the second massive case reported in recent days. After a bird flu inspection was reported at a farm in Taylor County on Friday, Iowa's governor immediately declared a disaster there to make sure the state has the resources to respond quickly. The Iowa case is just the latest one in the outbreak that began early last year and has prompted officials to kill a total of nearly 63 million birds. Last week, 1 million chickens were killed on a Minnesota egg farm. But the vast majority of cases, or nearly 58 million birds, occurred last year. Any time a case of bird flu is found, the entire flock is killed to help keep the highly contagious virus from spreading to another farm. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has been finding fewer wild birds carrying the virus this year, which suggests that some ducks and geese may be developing immunity. Farmers also have been working hard to keep the virus off their farms, and the government has been trying to respond quickly anytime bird flu is found. Iowa remains the hardest hit state in the nation, with more than 17 million birds killed there since the outbreak began. The state is the nation's leading egg producer, and egg farms tend to have the most birds. In one case last year, 5 million chickens were slaughtered on a single Iowa egg farm. Nebraska comes next, with more than 6.7 million birds killed, followed by Colorado's 6.26 million and Minnesota's 5.6 million. Most of the cases recently this fall have been found in Minnesota, South Dakota, and Iowa, along one of the major migratory paths ducks and geese follow as they fly south for the winter. The virus is spread easily by the droppings of those wild birds that can be tracked onto farms, and there has been an expected uptick in cases since the fall migration began. Poultry and egg farmers try to keep the virus from reaching their farms by requiring workers to shower and change clothes before they enter barns. Trucks are also sanitized before they enter the farm, and separate sets of tools are kept for each barn. The losses last year contributed to higher egg and poultry prices, but those prices have dropped significantly this year. Bird flu isn't believed to be a threat to food safety because officials slaughter all the birds on farms where the disease is found before they can enter the food supply, and properly cooking poultry and eggs to 165 degrees Fahrenheit will kill any viruses. Infections in humans are rare and usually come only in people with prolonged exposure to sick birds. Our next headline reads, North Iowa celebrates Veterans Day. North Iowa celebrated the contributions of veterans on Saturday, with ceremonies in Mason City and Clear Lake. The Mason City ceremony at Central Park consisted of the Pledge of Allegiance, led by MC Randy Solsa, along with an invocation and benediction by Chaplain Norris Hughes, a changing of the flags, and ended with a rifle squad from the Honor Guard and TAPS. Around 50 people attended the ceremony. In Clear Lake, donuts were served from 8 to 10 a.m. at the VFW, and an Honor Guard ceremony was conducted later Saturday afternoon. And here's a headline of local interest. Winnebago Tribe to get back 1,600 acres of land taken for proposed recreation area along the Missouri River. The Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska stands to receive 1,600 acres of land that was taken a half century ago for a recreation area that never materialized. The land on the Iowa side of the Missouri River would be returned under a bill introduced recently in the U.S. Senate by U.S. Senator Deb Fischer and her fellow Iowa and Nebraska senators, Pete Ricketts, Chuck Grassley, and Joni Ernst. The chairman of the Winnebago Tribe, Victoria Kitchian, said the return will be a historic and beautiful moment for her tribe, whose reservation is located north of Omaha. "We have been waiting for this wrong to be made right," Kitchian said in a press release that expressed thanks to the Nebraska and Iowa senators. The land was taken via eminent domain in the 1970s as part of a U.S. Army Corps of Engineer effort to stabilize the banks of the Missouri River and to establish a recreation area. A portion of the property on the Nebraska side of the river was eventually returned to the Winnebago tribe, but two tracts of land on the Iowa side of the river remain under Corps control. Fisher said it was wrong for the Corps to seize the land back in 1970, and it's time to make this right. The land is managed by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources as wildlife areas. In a recent management renewal agreement with the Army Corps, it was anticipated that the property would be returned to the tribe. Messages left with the Winnebago tribe to inquire about future plans for the land were not immediately returned. A press release from Fisher's office says the Bureau of Indian Affairs will hold the land in trust for the tribe. Our next headline reads, Moms for Liberty blessing turns curse in Iowa school board elections. The dateline is Des Moines. In 2021, school board elections in Iowa and across the country swung toward candidates who opposed pandemic-era restrictions on schools, including closures and mask mandates. 2 years later, that pendulum swung in the opposite direction, as candidates who supported restrictions on school materials and classroom discussions about gender and transgender students were roundly defeated earlier this week in school board elections in Iowa and in the nation. School board elections in the Lynn Mar, Ankeny, and Johnston school districts in Iowa, just to name a few, went almost exclusively for candidates who were supported by the teachers' union and who opposed those book policing and transgender student policies, and almost exclusively candidates who were endorsed by conservative groups, including the self-described parents' right advocacy group Moms for Liberty, failed. While Iowa Republicans caution against drawing broad conclusions about conservative K-12 education policies from Tuesday's elections, experts say the results spoke clearly. "I think the only way to read the school board elections from Tuesday is a repudiation of Moms for Liberty. They were defeated pretty handedly just about everywhere," said David Anderson, a political science professor at Iowa State University. "And it suggests to me," he says, "that Iowans have had their fill of the culture wars being brought to our schools." School board elections in Iowa are nonpartisan affairs. The candidates who run for the unpaid positions do not declare allegiance to a political party. In practice, however, many school board elections in recent years have featured the political divides of Democrat versus Republican or liberal versus conservative that are common to other areas of government. And increasingly, political groups and issue advocacy organizations are engaging in school board elections. And now turning to today's obituaries for Mason City. First, we remember Doris Jacobson. Doris Arlene Jacobson, age 103, formerly of Ventura, died Thursday, November 2nd in Sun Lakes, Arizona. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, November 20th at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel, located at 310 First Avenue North in Clear Lake. The family will greet friends and family 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will take place at the Clear Lake Cemetery. Next, we remember Roger Melman. Roger G. Melman, age 58, of Mason City, passed away on November 2nd after a long-fought battle with cancer. He spent his last days in care of his family and loved ones. A private family interment to celebrate Roger's life will be held at the Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery in Mason City at a later date. Memorials and cards may be directed to the family or sent to Hogan Bremer Moore, located at 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City. And now let's turn to Dear Abby. Abby responds to two letters today. The first one has a headline that reads, "Political spat over restaurant was bad manners." They write, "Dear Abby, my father-in-law and I are just cut from different cloth. We are political opposites, although we do get along for the most part. On a family vacation, we were visiting them. We were going out for dinner. My wife and I knew he was going to take us to a restaurant we both have ethical issues with. I handed him a 10% off coupon for a different nearby restaurant and said, 'Here's another option for dinner.' When he responded that he thought we'd go to the first place, I said, 'Sorry, I have some moral issues with it and won't eat there. Is there somewhere else we can go?' He then blew up at me, saying things like, 'If you're not paying, what difference does it make? And since you're our guest, it's rude of you to refuse.' My wife agreed that he was out of line. What do you think? Was it rude for us as their guests, or rude of him as a host to not accommodate us? And it's signed, 'Not going there in Nebraska.'" And Abby responds, "Dear Not Going, you have a loyal and loving wife. However, a more honest and less biased spouse would have pointed out privately that your manners were atrocious. A gracious guest accepts the hospitality offered by their host, rather than trying to turn the occasion into a demonstration of cancel culture. You owe your father-in-law an apology." And Abby's second letter today has a headline that reads, "Couple Bears Costs of Daughter's Medical Care." They write, "Dear Abby, my husband and I are retired and are both managing separate cancer diagnoses. This makes our finances hard to predict in the event one of us needs expensive medication. We did a good job saving for retirement and live comfortably. Our adult daughter contracted Lyme disease 10 years ago and became very ill. She endured years of painful treatments, which were not covered by insurance, during which time her husband divorced her. We stepped in to help with her medical bills. While the Lyme is no longer detectable in her system, some of the symptoms have never completely gone away. Now she's undergoing more tests, looking at a hormone imbalance. My husband is angry that we are still paying some of her medical bills. She works, has insurance, and pays for what she can. We can afford to help her, and I don't understand why her father doesn't want to help her anymore. We've argued about this many times over the years, and I'm frustrated with the situation. I'm not willing to give up on her like so many others have. What can I say to him the next time he confronts me about paying her medical bills?" And it's signed, "Devoted in Oregon." And Abby responds, "Dear Devoted, it may be time to stop arguing with your husband about this. Your adult daughter works and has medical insurance. You and your husband are both medically fragile. While I understand your desire to protect your daughter, you should not be supplementing her income if it threatens your access to the medications you may need in the future." And being as there's no new state news or local sports news, we'll turn to some national headlines. This one reads, "The AIPAC Summit is happening this week in San Francisco. What is AIPAC anyway?" The dateline is Washington. The United States is hosting the annual AIPAC Summit of World Leaders this week for the first time since 2011. Leaders from the 21-member Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Group will gather in San Francisco to talk about how to better spur trade and economic growth across the Pacific region. But the main event will actually be on the sidelines. A face-to-face meeting between President Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping. This year's conference is happening against the backdrop of the frosty relationship between China and the U.S. and global turmoil from the Israel-Hamas war and Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Here's a look at APEC and what it is and how it works. APEC stands for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. It's a forum to promote trade, investment, and economic development among other nations around the Pacific Ocean. The group started with 12 members in 1989, but has since grown to 21, including China, Russia, Japan, the U.S., and Australia. Those member nations pack a lot of punch, accounting for nearly 40% of the global population and almost half the world's trade. The annual Leaders Conference brings together heads of nations and other top economic and diplomatic leaders. Don't expect much of a presence from Russia this year. It's a pariah, as Russian President Vladimir Putin presses his country's invasion of Ukraine and will have lower-level representation. White House aides say the goal for this year's summit is to try to make APEC economies more resilient, particularly in the face of growing climate issues and following a global pandemic that killed millions of people and strained supply chains. The main event of this summit is unfolding on the sidelines, a meeting between Biden and Xi. The two leaders haven't spoken in person since they last met since they met last November during the Group of 20 summit in Bali, Indonesia. A lot has happened since then to ratchet up tensions between the superpowers. The Biden administration shot down a Chinese spy balloon that traversed the continental U.S. earlier this year. The Chinese government hacked the emails of Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo. The U.S. government restricted the export of advanced computer chips to China and has pushed to provide development aid to other nations to counter China's influence. The differences have also been exacerbated by Russia's war in the Ukraine and China's increasing assertiveness in the Taiwan Strait. But representatives from the U.S. and China have been meeting with increasing frequency lately, working to thaw relations. Still, the Biden-Xi meeting isn't expected to substantially alter the trajectory of U.S.-China relations. The forum has limited scope. It is centered on trade and economy. There is no military component, and it wasn't forged by a world-altering event like war. It technically has member economies rather than countries that allows room for participation by both China-ruled Hong Kong and self-ruled Taiwan. APEC's strength lies in its ability to get countries to work together on big initiatives and to ease business relations without binding agreements. Economists point to how APEC contributed to a reduction of tariffs and other barriers to trade. But the trade landscape is different now than when APEC began in a period of increased globalization. The U.S. strategy has been focused on economic competition with China rather than cooperation, even as U.S. leaders continue to stress the importance of cooperation. Biden is seeking partnerships with other nations in the region to develop alternatives to Chinese manufacturing imports, such as electronic equipment, machinery, furniture, textiles, and other goods. Biden is also trying to highlight progress on the new Indo-Pacific trade deal, started last year after President Donald Trump withdrew from the more popular Trans-Pacific Partnership. The conference has had its challenges and moments of drama in recent years. The group met virtually in 2020 and 2021 because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Leaders did gather in Bangkok last year, but Biden skipped the summit because his granddaughter was getting married, and he sent Vice President Kamala Harris in his place. That decision was regarded as a snub by some APEC leaders. Then, delegates from the United States and four other nations walked out to protest Russia's invasion of Ukraine as the Russian representative to the conference began to speak. Chile withdrew as an APAC host in 2019 due to mass protests. Last year, when Thailand hosted the summit in Bangkok, pro-democracy protesters challenged the legitimacy of the Thai prime minister, prompting police to fire at the crowd with rubber bullets that injured several protesters and a Reuters journalist. This year may give rise to friction over the Israel-Hamas war. The variety of nations involved in the summit have strong views on both sides of the conflict. Typically, at the close of the summit, there is some kind of joint statement by all the nations, but that's not a given this year, in part because of those differences. There is also some participation intrigue. Taiwan will once again be represented at the summit by Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company founder Morris Chang. The 92-year-old's lack of domestic political role allows him to meet with world leaders without fear of repercussions from China. Hong Kong, meanwhile, will be represented by Financial Secretary Paul Chan, Chief Executive John Lee, who is under U.S. sanctions for his role in a political crackdown in Hong Kong, opted out of the summit, citing scheduling issues. A potential U.S. government shutdown could also loom over the conference. The government will run out of money on Friday without a funding agreement between Congress and the president. It's a persistent reminder of U.S. political dysfunction, just as Biden seeks to project American reliability. The credit rating agency Moody's Investors Service lowered its outlook on the U.S. government's debt on Friday to negative, citing rising interest rates and political polarization in Congress. At the end of the APAC summits, the leaders typically pose together for a family photo. At the first leader-level meeting 3 decades ago, President Bill Clinton, hosting in Seattle, handed out matching leather bomber jackets similar to those worn by American fighter pilots. He apparently wanted his fellow VIPs to feel relaxed, and a tradition was launched. Since then, the APAC leaders have posed together in batik shirts in Malaysia in 1998, Chinese jackets in Shanghai in 2001, flowing ponchos in Chile in 2004, and aodai tunics in Vietnam in 2006. The Philippines' Barong Tagalog, a partially see-through embroidered shirt sewn from pineapple fiber and silk, was featured in the 1996 summit and again in 2015. It's not clear if the matching outfits will be back this year. The last time the U.S. hosted the conference in Hawaii in 2011, President Barack Obama nixed the idea. A reporter asked whether it was scrapped because the tradition felt too lighthearted amid ongoing concerns about the economy. No, Obama just thought they looked embarrassing. And continuing with national headlines, this one reads, Donald Trump Jr. is returning to the stand as defense looks to undercut New York civil fraud claims. The dateline is New York. Foiled in their long-shot bid for an early verdict, Donald Trump's lawyers will start calling witnesses of their own Monday in the New York civil fraud trial that threatens the former president's real estate empire. First up, Donald Trump Jr., who will be returning to the witness stand 2 weeks after state lawyers quizzed him during a major stretch of the trial that also featured testimony from his father and siblings Eric and Ivanka Trump. Trump's oldest son, a Trump Organization executive vice president, originally testified on November 1st and 2nd. He said he never worked on the annual financial statements at the heart of New York Attorney General Letitia James's lawsuit. He said he relied on the company's longtime finance chief and outside accounts to verify their accuracy. James alleges Donald Trump, his company, and executives, including Eric and Donald Jr., exaggerated his wealth by billions of dollars on financial statements given to banks, insurers, and others. The documents were used to secure loans and make deals. She is seeking more than $300 million in what she says were ill-gotten gains and a ban on defendants doing business in New York. Before the trial, Judge Arthur Engoron ruled that the defendants committed fraud by inflating his net worth and the value of assets on his financial statements. He imposed a punishment that could strip Trump of marquee properties like Trump Tower, though an appeals court is allowing him to remain in control for now. The Trumps have denied wrongdoing. Their lawyers contend that the state failed to meet any legal standard to prove allegations of conspiracy, insurance fraud, and falsifying business records. The state rested its case last Wednesday after 6 weeks of testimony from more than 24 witnesses, among them company insiders, accountants, bank officials, and Trump fixer-turned-foe Michael Cohen. The trial is proceeding after Engoron rebuffed the defense's request last week to end it early through what's known as a directed verdict. Engoron did not rule on the request, but indicated the trial would move ahead as scheduled. Trump lawyer Christopher Keyes, seeking a verdict clearing Trump and other defendants, argued last Thursday that the state's case involved only successful and profitable loan transactions and that there is no victim. There is no complainant. There is no injury, he said. After testifying in early November, Donald Trump Jr. echoed his father's claims that the case was purely a political persecution, brought by James, a Democrat, to blunt Trump's chances as the frontrunner of the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. I think it's a truly scary precedent for New York, for me, for example, before even having a day in court. I'm apparently guilty of fraud for relying on my accountants to do, wait for it, accounting, Trump Jr. told reporters on November 2nd. On Monday, Trump Jr. will be questioned first by the defense lawyers representing him, his father, and other defendants. A state lawyer is also expected to question him on cross-examination. Trump Jr. is expected to testify Monday and Tuesday, followed by a tax lawyer who also testified as a state witness. The defense also plans to call several expert witnesses as part of their case in an attempt to refute testimony from state witnesses that Trump's financial statements afforded him better loan terms, insurance premiums, and were a factor in deal making. When he became president in 2017, Donald Trump handed day-to-day management of his company to Eric and Donald Trump Jr. and named Trump Jr. as a trustee of a trust he established to hold his assets while in office. And that concludes today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, November 13th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening and have a great Monday.